Succession number 27195, Reel 1.
Colonel Williams, Reel 1. Colonel, could you tell me when you joined the army and what were your reasons for doing so?
I joined the army because while I was at school, I was meant to going to be a mining engineer, because my family were always mixed up in mining and smelting and banking down here. In fact, we ran an awful large percentage of the mines in Cornwall. My maths wasn't very good, so when it looked as if I couldn't get matriculation, which is the old A-level name for A-levels, as far as I can remember, my grandfather, who was paying for my education, wrote me a letter saying, "They say your maths isn't good enough, you'll never make Cameron School of Mines, and therefore you'll leave at the end of this term, go to a crammer, and you're going in the army." And I went, "Whoopee," at breakfast, "I'm going in the army, boys." And I left at the end of that term, delighted. I hated school, they didn't like me and I didn't like them. And I went to a crammer and went in the army.
Was there any tradition of military service in the family?
Yes. My father was 19th Hussars. The next brother was 12th Lancers. The younger of the three, Stephen Williams, was a horse gunner. My grandfather was yeomanry. And so there was nothing unusual about it. And both my sons are soldiers. One's a retired brigadier and the other commanded the Coldstream in Bosnia and is now Deputy Director of Military Intelligence for South East Europe.
When did you arrive at Sandhurst?
1938 it would have been, because we were there a year instead of 18 months. We were turned out after two terms. It's all in that. So we left. The two terms were kicked out. The seniors and the intermediates were turned out because of the threat of war, and we were commissioned on the 1st and 3rd of July in order to give the thing some... That's right, the 1st and 3rd of July. The seniors were commissioned on the 1st and the intermediates on the 3rd. That was to show there was a difference between them.
Maintaining seniority.
Yeah.
What do you remember about what you learned at Sandhurst?
Well, I've always said that I retired when I left Sandhurst, which is a slightly precocious sort of way of putting it. But no, I enjoyed Sandhurst very much. And I was a corporal. I was apparently going to be an under-officer. And I enjoyed everything about Sandhurst.
But do you remember what was on the syllabus of training when you were there?
Well, yes, it was the usual things that I dare say it is these days, although it may be slightly more academic now, but I mean there was tactics and military history. There was a lot of fitness and PT and gym and stuff. The equitation, as the riding schools were called, was one of my favourite things, because that's something I enjoyed very much. And I hoped to win the saddle. My father did, but I didn't. I was a runner-up for the saddle, and so on.
Do you remember what sort of tactical training you were given, and if it actually was directly relevant to the sort of tactics you employed during the Second World War?
No, I don't think it was particularly. What we did was nearly all in Barossa. We hardly ever went anywhere else. I think partly because there was a lot of pressure on, because Chamberlain was wandering about, and the war looked imminent. We spent quite a bit of time digging air raid shelters in front of the new buildings, housing number one company, where the flower beds are now. That was in the last half of our second term. That would have been in June.
1939. Yeah. Apropos of the approach of war, was there a moment at which you concluded that a war was inevitable? Can you remember that?
No, not at that age. I don't think we gave it any great, very serious thought. In fact, when war was declared, and Chamberlain made his great speech, we were actually had just left Gourock in the first convoy of the war, which had 1,700 officers on it, on our ship, nearly all Indian Army being recalled off leave. Colonel Orkin Leck was in charge of our boat. And when this came, we listened to the speech over the sort of tannoy thing, or wireless, whatever it was, in the saloon. And all we young ones out of Sanders all cheered like the devil. And the older chaps, who nearly all had First of all, ribbon, said, you young people don't know what the hell you're cheering for. Which, of course, is quite right.
So if the tactics weren't strictly appropriate, what sort of tactical training did you do on Barossa?
Oh, I don't know. We marched about and a certain amount of range work. And I don't really remember sort of there was anything very much sort of in the way of sort of what you might call section training or platoon training. Really, until one got to India and went on sort of, well, one was first put on an NCO's cadre anyway as a young officer, and a drill cadre. We were in London first doing London duties when I first joined, so we didn't sail till September.
Would you say then that the training at Sandhurst wasn't really strictly practical?
No, I'm sure it was all right for that period. I don't think any of us could drive. Well, it's very few of us could drive or anything like that. Cars went. There were very, very few cars at Sandhurst. There was a chap called Tony Rolt who had a thing called a Brough Superior, and his son still runs a firm called Rolt and Co. dealing in exotic cars and exotic car parts now. Because he's been down here shooting.
Do you remember on Barossa or on Yateley Common or anywhere around there, Hartford Flats, doing any toots?
No, I can't. We may have done, but I don't remember doing any.
Do you remember if, roughly speaking, you spent more time indoors than out, or the other way round, while you were at the academy?
Yes, I would think one probably did.
So it sounds as though it was basically theoretical training rather than in the field.
Yeah, I think it was.
But you did some shooting. What weapons did you?
Only Enfield, and we didn't have a Bren then, did we? We had a Lewis gun.
Bren was just coming in, I think.
Yes,
I
think so. But when we got to India, we had a thing called a Vickers Berthier, which was really quite like a Bren. It was probably one of the museums at Sandhurst, actually. A VB gun. Vickers Berthier, and that's what the Indian Army had.
Was this an air-cooled weapon?
Yeah. And it had similar sort of stoppages and things. Well, of course, the Lewis gun had awful stoppages as well.
Was it 37 stoppages on the Lewis?
Something like that.
Some phenomenal number.
Yeah.
Now, you say that when you heard that war had broken out, there was a sense of elation amongst the younger officers and the older officers.
Well, we all felt that that's what we'd been sort of trained for, you know, and it all sounded rather exciting.
Did you have any ideas about the course the war was like to take?
None at all. And we were at sea, bound for India, four of us as reinforcements to the 1st Battalion, which had been out there since 1919. And we joined the 2nd Battalion at the Tower of London, which is actually its Shorncliffe for doing London duties. And David Tyke, in fact, was home on leave received from India, and so he reported into the 2nd Battalion. And the four junior, there were seven of us, because we were two terms being kicked out, Sandhurst, so there were seven of us. The four junior, I suppose it was the four junior, anyway, four of us were selected for to go out the first time in India, who were stationed in Lahore.
Can I ask you how you chose your regiment? Was this did you choose the DCLI or did the DCLI choose you?
I think my grandfather so there was an instructor at Sandhurst called Filippo in charge of the gym, and he tried to enlist me because I was Cornish, and there was just room for me, particularly as there were seven joining on those two intakes. And old Edward Blythe, who was the Lord Lieutenant, had a bit of push too, and saw to it that I got into it.
And were you happy to go into the infantry rather than the cavalry?
Yes, perfectly. what I didn't want to do was be a gunner, which my uncle Stephen, who was a horse gunner, had tried to get me to go to Woolwich. And in fact, during the army exam, because I took it from the crammer, during the maths papers, the army exam, I was riding somebody else's horse in the Aldershot Horse Show, so it didn't really help very much.
You were not mathematically inclined.
No, not really. And I think it mattered then for gunners and sappers.
Still does.
Still does. Mm. But,
so it sounds as though then it was simply a natural choice of regiment as a result of your origins.
Yes, I think probably, yeah.
I mean, did you consider any other?
No, it wasn't. It didn't appear to be anything to do with me. I mean, I was told I was going in the army, and I said, fine. And then Major Philippot, who was a splendid chap, got killed in France, got hold of me and said, would I join the Duke Cornwall Light Infantry? I said, fine, yeah, because I had two or three friends in Sandhurst who were all doing it, you see. Aldi Dorian Smith and people were all great friends of mine. So of the seven of us that joined, there were four of us who knew each other out of the seven. Johnny Howard, who I think you've spoken to already.
JTC Howard,
yeah,
yes.
Well, I was at prep school with him and one thing or another. And his younger brother, who I think was killed somewhere in the Navy, I think. And Dickie Burke was killed. Hugh Jobson, I knew vaguely. Aldi Dorian Smith was my great friend. Down here and sort of around school and places like that too. So that was, it's quite natural to have gone into the county regiment.
Now, you were initially on public duties.
Yes.
What did that entail doing?
Exactly the same as they do now. They put us in the Tower of London and attached a drill sergeant to us. I can't remember if he was a grenadier or a Coldstream, but anyway, we had, and we drilled in the moat in the early mornings, and then when we were doing either Buckhouse Guards or Bank Guard, which are the two that one did, we moved into Chelsea Barracks for that. And one actually mounted guard from Chelsea Barracks in the same way as Brigade of Guards do now. There's been no change in that.
How much notice did you need to be sent to India on a draft?
I think about 4 days. We were told we had to try and get hold of topies. So John Trelawney, who was a cousin of mine, and I went down. We tried people like Herbert Johnson in London, who said no, they couldn't help with the topi at all. So we eventually went down to the East India docks, and we found some warehouse down there where we found some topies. And they hadn't got puggeries on them or anything like that. They're just basic topies. Of course, we didn't wear them when we got out to India. The ones we issued out there were quite different. But anyway, that was all. We literally had about 4 days' notice. And one had time to go home and say goodbye. And down here, as far as I was concerned, I spent about 2 hours the last night up a tree with a bull underneath. I took a short cut across the park down to Scaria. And this bull was only let out at night. And as it's a bull, I used to tease at times.
it was a needle match.
Yes, it was a needle match. But
how did you manage to escape from it in the end?
Eventually the bull got bored, I think, because I was up this thorn tree. And I climbed down very quietly and tiptoed away downwind.
And he didn't hear you?
No, he'd lost me by then. Mm. He'd gone off to look at his girlfriends.
What did you feel about being sent out to India?
They're terrific.
Happy? You were?
Terrific, yeah.
You weren't worried that you might miss the war in Europe?
No, I don't think it affected one at all. And one was going into a battalion of the army, which one didn't expect it to stay there, for instance, in India. And one didn't really know very much about it. And it wasn't until I got to Sandhurst that I knew there was an Indian army, as against the army in India. And I mean, there were more people in the Indian army than there were in the army in India. But I mean, it was only at Sandhurst one heard of people like the Rajputana Rifles, and the Gwalis, and the Gurkhas, and things. One had ever heard of them. I mean, I wasn't brought up on sort of military history in any way.
So all quite new.
Yes. Mm.
Did you learn any military history at your crammer when you were preparing?
No, I don't think so. Not that I can remember. One just spent one's time doing doing the entrance papers for Woolwich. And you make the mark on that, one got in a Sandhurst.
What do you remember what the subjects were? You mentioned mathematics. What else was there?
Oh, I can't remember.
I can't remember.
No.
Was it basic school subjects?
I think so. Mm.
But you did get some instruction, obviously, in the overall structure of the army and its role and capabilities when you were in...
At Sandhurst.
In the Royal Military College.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Very much so. Yeah.
So you got on the trooper at Gurup. Wasn't this a regular military trooper? Or was
no, it wasn't.
Minor?
No, it was a thing called the Empress of Britain. No, the Empress of the Duchess of Bedford. CPR boat, the Duchess of Bedford, rapidly christened the Drunken Duchess. Half the crew refused to sail. It wasn't Gurup, it was Liverpool.
It was Liverpool?
Yeah, I think it was Liverpool. I came to Gurup another time and we came back from Italy. It was Liverpool. And there was a Drunken Duchess. There was another big ocean-going liner, too, which had been pulled in, which was next door to us. I can't remember what it was called now. And Hugh Jobson's father was on that, which is a great relief. And also a chap called Vic Williams, no relation of mine, who was in this regiment, who was a very serious-minded man. And thank God he was on the other boat, because he wouldn't have approved of the way we behaved at all.
How did you behave?
Oh, very badly. Half the crew refused to sail because of the threat of war. So we painted the ship grey as we sailed along from white.
You were involved in the painting?
Oh, yeah, sure. And we were on fatigues, humping food up from the frozen areas into the galleys each day. They had two... quite decent. I don't know what they were. They were sort of 6-pounders, or they may have been 12-pounders. One screwed on the front, one screwed on the back, and we had gun teams for those, and we manned them throughout on a sort of roster. And we did all sorts of duties on board.
So you were in the artillery after all,
yes.
In a sense.
Yeah. And we sailed away. We went, God knows where we went. We went sort of right out into the Atlantic, and then came back and. Through Gib and through the Med, and stopped at port side long enough to re-water, and everybody was allowed off there. There were no women on board at all, and I'm afraid three of us snitched a model out of Simon Arts in a cotton dress. We took her on board with us, and she got sung to every night. And as we went, sailed into Bombay the last night, the cruiser Exeter, I think, was our escort. We pulled her up to the main masthead. And the cruiser came alongside as dawn broke and a signal came flashing across. Nursing sister hung her down. Hung herself, please cut her down. My grandfather got to hear of it and was furious. Threatened to stop my allowance.
Did he?
No.
Did you... So the crew, the ship sailed, did it sail with just half crew, or did you get...
No, about half crew, I think.
Yeah. And it was a civilian crew rather than a naval crew?
Oh, yes, no, it was just the crew of the Duchess of Bedford.
Now, besides the Duchess of Bedford, I mean, what else was in this convoy? Presumably it was not just you and...
No, there was this other big, biggish liner, which was also full of Indian Army recalled off leave and reinforcements going out. There were several other ships, that some of which I think probably dropped off at Gib and Malta and Portside and another like that. We weren't the very big convoy either once we got through Portside, which would make sense. Convoy into India, so there was pretty fair chaos. The Taj Mahal Hotel, which is the biggest hotel there, had in there about 6 to a room. And then we did a 3-day journey up to Long Train.
On the voyage, were there any possibilities?
Yes. We had various alarms from sent in from the Exeter, and the one or two destroyers were the two, I think, on suspected enemy submarines and all sort of thing like that. But we didn't actually have any casualties. I think there was some depth charges let off in one period.
What about the air? Were there any threats from the air?
No. I don't think the Germans have got any out over the Atlantic by then. There was certainly nothing in the Mediterranean those days. When did Italy come in the war?
Not until late 1940.
No, quite. Well, you see, the Mediterranean was quite. sorry, I got a bit of a cold.
What was the accommodation like on the Drunken Duchess?
Oh, it was fine. I can't remember sort of how many we were to a cabin, but if the cabin had four bunks, we were four in it. And it wasn't overloaded. The troops, I think, had plenty of the troops that were on board. I got very friendly with three Rough Riders out of the remount department in India. They were part of the trouble that we got into.
You're not saying you were led astray.
Well, they were most amusing. They were, and but there was plenty of room on board.
Was there anything organised in the way of training or anything of that sort to keep you occupied while you were en route? How did you pass the time?
I think there may have been a certain amount of PT on deck, but I honestly can't remember anything else. I think we played poker most of the way. As I say, Auchinleck, who of course was Indian Army, was a senior officer, and he no sooner got to Bombay than he was turned around and sent back to Norway. As I think were several of the other Indian Army officers who had Northwest Frontier experience.
Up to the mountains.
Yeah.
What impression did you get of Port Said?
It was a filthy place. It always has been. And it would be exactly the same then as it is now.
And was this your first trip abroad?
First out going out that way. I was born in New Zealand, so we used to come back Panama Canal. I did the Panama three times, I suppose. We came home in 1925 when I was five, and then in 1929 for good when I was nine. So it's a completely different trip.
So you arrived at Bombay, you were in the hotel, then did you go up to Lahore by rail?
Yeah, it takes 3 days. Yeah.
And what happened at Lahore? Presumably this was the grand sorting out process.
No, it was only the people who had gained Lahore. Mm. And further north. And people going to Pune or Madras or somewhere like that would have gone completely different trains, you know. But everybody moved by train in those days. Very good trains they were too. But I had one fascinating thing happened. On arrival at Bombay, and no sooner got onto the dockside, I was just sort of young 19-year-old, you know. And a little man shuffled up to me in a big pugri and with a letter in his hand. And he said, "Saab, I am your bearer." And he had a letter from my Uncle Stephen, whose bearer he'd been some years before, who'd written to him and said, "Would he come and look after me? That I was arriving in India," and he couldn't say what date it was because security, one thing or another like that. So the little man must have come down to Bombay to meet ships coming in, not knowing when it was going to arrive. He'd given up being bearer to a colonel in his family, purely on the loyalty to my uncle. And he looked after me for a year, and then he tapped up one day and he said, "I've looked after you for a year. My nephew, Carfax, will look after you now." And he went off back up to the family he'd been working for before, who would like to see him back.
How did you identify you?
I don't know. I didn't bother to think about it. There we were, we all got off the ship at long last, and this little man comes up with a letter from my uncle, and he said, "I am your bearer." Most extraordinary. And he said, "What baggage have you got?" And I think I'd said to him that I'd got a couple of suitcases or something rather like that. And I didn't think about it anymore. And 2 days later, when we got on the train for Lahore, the little man was there with my baggage. And my baggage was in the compartment that I was in. And he said, "I'm further back in the train." And each month I used to draw my pay and give it to him. And at the end of the month, he brought me an account.
So he was a man of business for you as well as a servant.
It was the easy way of doing it. One never carried money in India. You signed chits for everything, you see. But I mean, it's a good example of the sort of loyalty that you could get off those people, which you certainly don't get off any African servant. You might get it off a Chinese servant. I've had very good Chinese servants, but it was the most extraordinary thing, really.
And how did the nephew compare with the...
Oh, he's all right. He's a young chap. We only had about 4 months to go then, I think. And
did he go with you when you left India?
No.
Just stayed behind?
Yeah. But and I had several horses and things, and he was a supervisor, sort of, sizes the grooms, and I never ordered any food or anything, hay or chaff, and they used to get fed on. It was all done by him. He'd bring me a little count of the whole damn thing. He's always just about in credit.
Could you live on your pay, or did you have to depend on your allowance?
Well, I haven't got very much of an allowance. As far as I know, I think we did. Won money. I think we got 11. When we were in London, we missed an 8 shillings. You wouldn't get much change out of that lot. One lived very well on one's pay. You see, we didn't have a motor car. I had a little pony and a thing called a tum-tum, which was made in the bazaar out of basket work with 4 bicycle wheels and 2 shafts, and you drove this pony. And with a small boy, who also got paid something by my bear, I don't know what he was paid, who stood up behind and held the pony's head when you got out. And if you went out dancing, which one did at least twice a week, the small boy sort of sat at the head of the pony and went to sleep on the ground until you came out and wanted to go home again. But we had about half a dozen of these tum-tums. They were great fun.
Where was the battalion when you joined it?
In Lahore.
In Lahore. Mm. What were they actually doing there?
Internal security. And there was a certain amount of trouble. The people called the Khaksars, K-H-A-K-S-A-S. And they were armed with sharpened shovels, long-handled shovels. In fact, there's one in the museum, I think, somebody brought back. And they were extremely lethal, Balshi people. I can't remember what the hell it was all about. But we used to try and sort them out now and again. And one did a lot of internal security sort of drills with the police and having to get the magistrate to sign and telling him to hang on to the magistrate. And once he'd signed, he wouldn't let him push off, you know.
This was riot drill.
Yeah.
Mm. Apart from riot drill, what other sorts of internal security?
Internal, not much else apart from that. We did a lot of ordinary training, ordinary tactical training, and out from the barracks, and then for a fortnight each year, and that involved 2 camps, in fact, because I suppose there was one in 40 and one in 41 before we left. One marched out about 20 miles into a camp, and you did a lot of tactical training and exercises out there, and we had brigade exercises, and there was a brigade headquarters in Lahore, and the 19th Lancers, who were Indian cavalry, were there. And it was depot, one of the Punjab regiments, the 8th, I think. And first you called us, I didn't know was in there, but others came in from Fraserpur and Jalandhar and places to, was part of the brigade. And we won hot weather. We did a lot of training north of Lahore, up the Grand Trunk Road, and in the Pubby Hills, P-A-B-B-I. We marched over 100 miles up the Grand Trunk Road to get there. This all started because some Indian Army general said the British troops were no good in the hot weather. Well, we showed them that we were, but it was quite hard going.
What sort of rate of march could you get out of troops?
Well, it was the old story. You march for 50 minutes, and then you halted for 10. And I reckon you probably got 3 to 3.5 miles an hour.
And how many hours in the day would you do?
We march about 8.
So you're doing about 25 miles a day.
Mm.
And would you start very early in the morning?
Yes, in India you do. Yeah, because it's cool.
Do Did you start before first light, or did you wait until the first?
It was definitely as early. No, I wouldn't have said we started sort of before first light. I think it's about first light. And you see, the only transport we had was camels and mules.
Who managed those? Did you have native?
No, not a bit. We had I was horse transport officer, and we had about 10 AT carts, animal transport AT carts, which were wooden, two-wheeled, metal things, and they were pulled by a mule each.
What sort of load could you put into one of those?
Well, you'd get 400 or 500 weight into it, probably.
That's a lot of large packs.
Yeah, but and things like water containers. And then the quarter bar sergeant probably had about